Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the confusion over ballots in California's upcoming June 7th primary, which has some supporters of Bernie Sanders crying foul, since those independents who registered to vote with a no-party preference or NPP ballot have received their vote-by-mail ballot that has no presidential candidate listed. Since supporters of Bernie Sanders have already sued in federal court to have the registration deadline that passed on Monday, May the 22nd, extended until Election Day, as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders battled it out until the end for the big delegate prize in California, we'll try to clear the air. California State Senator Ben Allen, the chair of the Senate Elections and Constitutional Amendments Committee, and Deborah Seiler, the former Registrar of Voters for San Diego County, join us to discuss how many independents have registered with the American Independent Party, founded in the 1960s by the racist George Wallace, and how some of the parties themselves have created the confusion by not allowing NPP voters to request their party's presidential ballot or participate in their presidential primary election. Then we'll examine the latest battle for Fallujah underway in Iraq, which has the UN warning that 10,000 civilians trapped in the city are at risk, while another 10,000 of the approximately 100,000 residents have already been killed. Iraqi-born Rayed Jarrah, the government's relations manager at the American Friends Services Committee in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the continuing suffering of the Iraqi people in this endless war started by the Bush-Cheney administration, which has yet to be held to account. Then finally, we will look into the theater of the absurd on Capitol Hill, where today Republican congressmen used a Judiciary Committee hearing to push for the impeachment of the IRS commissioner, John Koskinen, with Congressman Daryl Issa fuming because the head of the IRS had not shown up and spitefully preventing the Democrats from reading the commissioner's testimony into the record. Bob McIntyre, the director of Citizens for Tax Justice, joins us to discuss the determination of Tea Party anti-government zealots to impeach the head of the IRS to cripple the government they hate, even though their colleagues in the Senate want nothing to do with the House's impeachment theatrics. And joining us now is California State Senator Ben Allen, who represents California's 26th Senate District and serves as chair of the Senate Elections and Constitutional Amendments Committee. And also joining us is Deborah Seiler, the former Registrar of Voters for San Diego County. Welcome to you both, Senator Ben Allen and Deborah Seiler.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the senator on the confusion here. I mean, is this really a case of real confusion, or is there a sense of partisanship in this, given that a supporter of Bernie Sanders sued in federal court, William Simpich? Now, his federal lawsuit, of course, alleging widespread confusion in California, he wanted the voter registration to be extended past yesterday's deadline. That didn't happen. So quantify the level of confusion and what's causing it, if you will, Senator.
Well, look, the rules have been the rules for some time. The big difference is now that we finally have a contested election, a presidential election here in California. Usually, we're so far at the end of the calendar that no one really cares by the time it gets to us. And so, yes, there is confusion. A lot of Californians aren't used to these rules. We have changed over to a top two system for everything else except for the presidential primary. And so people are used to this open primary system now, where anybody can come in and vote on any for any position. But with the presidential, we are still subject to the party rules. And the fact is that the different parties have different rules. Do not allow no party preference, do not allow independent voters to vote in their primary under any circumstances for the presidency. On the Democratic side, the Democrats do. And so this has led to a certain amount of confusion. We're here to, we're working really hard to try to clear up the confusion that exists. We've been getting information out. There's a lot of work that's currently underway amongst our various registrars and our Secretary of State and others to try to make sure people better understand the rules.
So, Deborah, my understanding is that no party preference voters, the NPP voters, have received their mail-in ballots, and these ballots have no presidential candidates listed. So what do those people do?
Well, if a no party preference voter receives a ballot and it does not have the presidential campaign on it, that means that they probably did not follow the instruction given to them from the Registrar of Voters, who sent out a postcard several months ago asking them if they wanted to vote in one of the parties that allowed no party preference voters to vote in that primary, to make that request. I personally am a no party preference voter, and I sent in the card and received the appropriate ballot. If a voter, though, finds themselves in the position where they do want to vote in one of the presidential contests that allows no party preference voters, they can call, they can go into the elections office, they can request a mail ballot, or of course, they can always go to the polls on election day. All they need to do, if they have a ballot already, take that ballot into the polling place, surrender it, and receive the ballot of their choice. Now, obviously, they cannot, as Senator Allen said, they cannot receive the Republican ballot, but they can receive the Democrat and American Independent ballot, among others.
But, Senator Allen, the American Independent, I mean, isn't that a source of confusion? A lot of people registered, and first of all, in context, the largest voting bloc in the United States are independents. I think there are more independents than there are registered Democrats and Republicans. So my understanding is a lot of independents, in other words, there's not a blanket list of independent parties. So the word independent being associated with the American Independent Party, independents are registering under that party without knowing that it goes back to the days of the racist candidacy in the South.
George Wallace. 1968, Wallace, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, the LA Times did a big front page story about this. And the interesting thing is that since that story came out showing that all these folks who thought they were registered as independents or others were actually registered as American independents, I think something like 30,000 Californians have now switched and dropped their affiliation with the American Independent Party. So the good news is the LA Times did a good job of getting the word out and informing people about the fact that this party is confusing. I think it's purposely confusing. We'll see where that goes. I mean, ultimately, it's a historical vestige from the 60s, as you say. But the good news is the word is finally getting out and people are understanding that the American Independent Party is not what people think it is.
So, but how does an independent register if they are generally independent? In other words, they haven't made up their mind. Is there a kind of grab bag list of independents with Greens and Peace and Freedom and American Independent?
Well, I mean, when you register to vote, you indicate whether you want to affiliate with a party or not. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then you are what is called a no party preference voter. So that's how you register as an independent, I suppose.
Right, but as Deborah's just pointed out, you get this ballot that has no presidential candidates listed on it. So it's
is correct, sir. Yeah. But the county registrars send out postcards to voters prior to the primary, several months prior to the primary, and they make sure that those voters understand you're registered as a no party preference voter, and you have the three options of ballots. What are they? Certainly the Democrats, the American Independent, and I believe the Libertarian Party also allows the no party preference voters to select their ballots. So that information is given out there.
And one thing to remember, we are not voting for the President of the United States this June 7th. We're voting for the party nominations for the presidency of the United States. We're all going to be able to vote together for who will actually become president in November. But right now, this is the primary process determining who will be the nominees of the various political parties to run for president.
And again, I'm speaking with California State Senator Ben Allen, who represents California's 26th district and serves as chair of the Senate Elections and Constitutional Amendments Committee. And also joining us is Deborah Seiler, the former Registrar of Voters for San Diego County. But nevertheless, Senator Allen, there is a real political context to this in this moment of this national primary underway, where the Republican side has pretty much decided on the Democratic side. It's not. and there's a fairly contentious and continuing battle between the two leading candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, on the Democratic side, and California may well be the last stand. It's going to be pretty difficult for Bernie Sanders to, I think he has to get something like 97% of the vote in California, but nevertheless, he's taking the fight all the way, and he's done very well in states where they have allow independents to vote, as opposed to closed primaries where only registered Democrats can vote. So that is, shall we say, the subtext here and what's going on?
Yes, that absolutely. We just want, from our perspective as folks helping to try to run the system, we want to make sure that everybody is able to participate to the full extent of the law as they possibly can. We understand there's a lot of energy and excitement out there. This has been an unprecedented electoral presidential election, and we just want to make sure people know so that they don't end up being disappointed. So if folks want to be, if you're an independent voter and no party preference and you want to vote for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, you've got to take some steps to be able to participate in the Democratic primary. And we want to make sure people know about that.
And given that the registration deadline is passed, what is the next step? How do you do this? I mean, obviously, we're trying to educate voters right here in this conversation, but obviously, then it has to be a broader outreach.
Well, any no party preference voter can go into the polling place on election day, and they simply have to request the ballot they wish, which is, as I said before, one of the three parties. But they can do that up to election day. They could also go into the elections office and request a mail ballot. They could go into the elections office and vote early. And again, they have all those options up through election day.
But only the American Independent Democratic and Libertarian parties. I take it that the Greens and the Peace and Freedom haven't taken the MPP route.
That's right. They've chosen not to allow no party preference voters to participate in their presidential primary election. And it's interesting. I was chatting with Deborah about this earlier. And the registrars, in some ways, are basically forced to deal with all these crazy party rules. Each of the parties, we've got six parties, and they all have different rules. And the registrars are kind of stuck there trying to apply the party rules that are not voted on. They're not determined by the legislature or the people. They're done by the parties. And do so in a way that ends up being fair. And I think it's part of the challenge that they have. You're absolutely right. The American Independent, Democratic, and Libertarian parties allow no party preference and allow independent voters to vote in their primary processes as long as they follow the procedures. Republican, Green, and Peace and Freedom do not allow no party preference folks to participate in their presidential election, their presidential nomination process. So you've got to be registered in one of those three parties if you want to participate in their process.
So, Senator Allen, what would you say then to a Bernie Sanders supporter? Because already a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters feel that the game has been rigged against him in terms of superdelegates, and now there's some restiveness about the voting. And what can you say to assuage people that somehow the electoral system here in California is not stacked against Bernie Sanders?
Go to the polls. Go vote. Participate in the process. Learn what you need to do if you're a no party preference voter, but participate and vote. I mean, Bernie Sanders has won all sorts of states all over the country, and I think he's got a chance here. We have an open process, and folks need to participate.
So, Deborah Seilert, the former registrar of voters for San Diego County. This lawsuit that tried to extend registration past yesterday's deadline by a supporter of Bernie Sanders alleged that election officials in some of California's 58 counties aren't making it clear to these unaffiliated voters how to vote. So is that a valid criticism? Because, again, it feeds into this idea that a lot of the Sanders voters have, is that they're fighting against a rigged system.
Well, I don't think the system is rigged. I'm a little surprised that the Sanders campaign is surprised, because these rules have been in place for quite some time now. And the registrars, I think, have done a very good job with the resources they have, both on their websites, through their sample ballot booklets, through individual mailings, to alert no party preference voters to their options. So I don't see, frankly, what the Sanders campaign is really complaining about, because I think those steps have already been taken. I think we have abundant evidence of that.
So the fact that the deadline has passed for registering, what advantage would that have had, or what would that have solved, Simtish's lawsuit, which, by the way, was joined by the Voting Rights Defense Project, which is an organization that campaigns on behalf of Bernie Sanders. So,
well, no party preference voters don't need to re-register to participate in the Democratic presidential primary election. They don't need to register. They only need to request that ballot. So the fact that the registration deadline has passed really only affects those who would like to vote in the Republican primary or the Peace and Freedom or Green Party primary. Mm-hmm. It does not affect the Democrats.
But they now need to take action if they want to vote by mail. I mean, anybody can go in person at the polls if they're registered to vote, request that Democratic Party ballot, and vote in the polls. So that's one thing that people ought to know. If you for whatever reason you haven't gotten your ballot by mail, you can go to your polling location, request a Democratic ballot if you're no party preference voter, and vote on Election Day.
And registrars of voters have lots and lots of people manning the phones. There are many calls going into county offices now. Registrars are actively trying to educate people on their options. If they want to request a vote by mail ballot, the application does have to arrive by May 31st. But even after that, they can go into the elections office and request the ballot in person and or vote it right there in the elections office. So there are still many options for no party preference voters.
Let me give folks the voter information line for Los Angeles County, though, too, so people can call if they have additional questions. It's 1-800-815-2666, 800-815-2666, and that's the voter information line at L.A. County Registrar Recorder.
So what's going on here then, Senator Allen? Is there just sort of confusion that's been hyped, or do you think there is genuine confusion? Because, as you pointed out, you know, this is somewhat, these primaries are somewhat controlled by the parties, and the idea that some of the parties, the American Independent, the Democrat, and the Libertarian, decided to join in, if you will, with no party preferences, giving people options, but whereas the Greens and the Peace and Freedom didn't. So if there is confusion, what would you attribute it to, the parties themselves or the system?
I mean, part of it's the parties themselves. I mean, look, in some ways, this is a symptom of actually something that's very good, which is that we've got a lot of interest this year. People are excited. People want to engage. People are finding relevance in this presidential election, and they're excited about the candidates, and they're excited about engaging. And that's something we don't usually have for our California presidential primaries, because we're usually so late in the calendar. And now this election is relevant, so people are excited. Also, we're getting a lot of people involved who haven't voted before, who haven't been as involved, who haven't been as engaged. And so for them, the voting process might be a little less familiar. And so, you know, we're stuck with a set of rules. I will say hope is on the way, in the sense that by 2018, we will have same-day registration. And then after that, everyone will have automatic registration in the state. So there are some rule changes happening that will make the system clearer and expand the franchise. We're actually also in the process right now of working on legislation to create vote centers that would be open for 10 days before Election Day, that would allow people to come in anytime, or even including on the two full weekends before Election Day, and participate in the process. So we're still stuck with some old vestiges. The legislature is working to try to change some of the rules. We're also, of course, at the same time dealing with the party rules themselves. As I say, this is a process to determine who is the nominee of the various political parties, and ultimately those parties have control over their own internal processes and practices, and that does lead to confusion. I understand why people are confused, because, you know, right, if the Republican rules are totally different from the Democratic rules, the Green Party rules are different from the Libertarian rules, and the registrars are kind of stuck in the middle.
Well, let's just close then with the last word from Deborah Seiler, as a former registrar of voters for San Diego County. What could have been done, do you think, to avoid this confusion? Even though, with the caveat that the parties themselves may have created most of this confusion, as somebody that is a former registrar of voters for San Diego County, do you think there's something that could have been done to make this situation easier and not have it become a kind of issue that sort of has a sort of partisan tinge to it?
Well, perhaps what could have been done is that the Sanders campaign might have been more informed about the rules in California and brought this to the public attention sooner. That perhaps would have been helpful. But I do believe that both the Secretary of State and the county registrars have really done a very good job in terms of alerting no party preference voters. As I said, I personally am a no party preference voter, and I receive plenty of information and plenty of time to take the appropriate action. And there is still time. There's plenty of time for people to take action and vote the ballot of their choice through one of those political parties that allows them to do it. You are correct. The process is not intuitive. It's not intuitive for voters. It's not intuitive for perhaps the media, and it's not intuitive sometimes for poll workers. But this is where the county and the state's efforts for training poll workers and informing voters is critically important. And I think they do a good job.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Deborah Seiler, again, the former Registrar of Voters for San Diego County, and California State Senator Ben Allen, who represents the 26th District and serves as Chair of the Senate Elections and Constitution Amendments. I thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you.
Go vote, everybody.
We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the latest battle for Fallujah underway in Iraq.
The future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, if I still go, if I still go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Raed Jarrah, who is the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., focusing on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raed Jarrah.
Thank you for having me.
And Raed, you're a native of Iraq and now obviously an American citizen, but you do go back to your native land, which is a very painful place, is it not? I mean, I just for the life of me don't understand how the Iraqi people can endure the agony that they've endured ever since George Bush and Dick Cheney decided to conduct regime change. The fact that today there's a new battle of Fallujah, of course, most people remember that from the big battle the Marines were involved in during the U.S.-Iraq war, but now the city is surrounded and being pounded by the Iraqi army along with Iranian help, and there are 10,000 civilians trapped, and the U.N. is warning that there could be a wholesale massacre of civilians. So this is, again, you know, I guess you keep revisiting the scene of the crime.
You're right. It's a deja vu. It's the same destruction and the same story being repeated over and over again. And I think hearing the name of the city, Fallujah, brings up many memories from the U.S. Atrocities and attacks back in 2003 and 2004 and 2005, and the fact that the city is still going through more military action and more destruction is definitely a part of the U.S. legacy in what happened to Iraq because of the U.S. interventions.
So what's your understanding of the humanitarian situation that the U.N. is warning about? Because the figure of 10,000 people in jeopardy has been released, but there are about 100,000 civilians all told, are there not, in Fallujah?
You're right. I mean, it's not really only a humanitarian crisis. I agree with the UN assessment that this is an alarming situation, but I would take it one step farther than what the UN has been saying, because I think that it is even more concerning than only a humanitarian crisis. It is a political crisis, and this political crisis has been leading the country towards more violence and destruction. Let me give you an example to demonstrate what the point that I'm trying to make. So in some cases, there is violence that happens in countries, and then as a consequence, as an unintended result to this to fighting, there are some civilians who get displaced. In the case of Iraq, it's even more complicated because the displacement of people in Iraq has been one of the goals behind organized violence. So whether we're talking about militias such as ISIS or militias attached and affiliated to the Iraqi government, Shiite militias or Kurdish militias that are funded and trained by the Iraqi government and indirectly by the United States, all of these militias have been conducting a campaign of ethnic and sectarian cleansing. So when it comes to affecting civilian lives, this is not a byproduct to military operations. This is the actual intended result of some of these military operations. And yesterday, we saw how the spokesperson of the largest Shiite militia affiliated with the Iraqi government announcing that Fallujah is a cancer. It's a tumor and a cancer that should be get rid of. The language is almost genocidal when it comes from these militias that are affiliated with the United States.
Well, that's one of the problems, isn't it, that you have, even though ISIS and or Daesh has shown that it's extraordinarily barbaric, nevertheless, the people in the areas that it occupies, in this case Fallujah, but also in Mosul, which is also under siege, they're probably more afraid of the Iraqi government and these Shiite militias than they are of ISIS. That's my understanding.
Your understanding is unfortunately accurate. And imagine how bad the Iraqi government has been and how violent and sectarian and corrupt that there are many Iraqis who fear their own government more than what they fear ISIS. You know, we're talking about a group that has been murdering civilians and burning them. Last week, ISIS lowered a group of prisoners into a pool of acid and killed them in that way. And still, Iraqi civilians are more scared of the Iraqi central government that is funded and trained by the U.S. government than ISIS. I mean, doesn't that tell you an important part of the story, an important part of the legacy that the United States has left in Iraq, that the country is led by brutal sectarian militias that are terrifying people around the country, and many people would choose to stay under the rule of a crazy group such as ISIS, not because they like ISIS, but because in a way ISIS is less crazy than the U.S.-funded and trained government in Baghdad.
And again, I'm speaking with Raed Jarrah, who's a government relations manager at the American Friends Services Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. And what do you make then, Raed, of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force commander, General Qasem Soleimani? He's like number one on the U.S. wanted list for various connections to all kinds of terrorist acts, going back to the bombing of the Marine barracks, etc. Not a real popular guy on the American side, but nevertheless, here he is strutting around Fallujah with the Iraqi army and directing the battle from what we understand. And so how do you explain that the government that we support in Baghdad has this character helping them out? Doesn't that put us in an odd situation?
Well, this is not new. The Iranian role in Iraq is as problematic, if not more problematic, than the United States' role in Iraq nowadays. And the Iranian role and intervention in Iraq started back in 2003 under the Bush administration. So unlike the tensions between Iran and the U.S. in Lebanon, where they had proxy wars there, you know, Iran supported some factions and the U.S. supported others. In Palestine and Israel, you know, the U.S. supported some factions and Iran supported others. In Iraq, the U.S. and Iran were on the same side of what was going on since the invasion of 2003. So they both supported the same ruling parties. Many of the ruling parties came back from Iran to Iraq after 2003. And there were open sessions of coordination about the U.S.-Iranian role in Iraq under the Bush administration. There were three official and open sessions about coordination. So I'm actually very critical of Iran's role in Iraq, as much as I am critical of the United States or other countries interfering in the country. Now, Iran's role in Iraq and Syria have been increasing. The intervention, the military intervention in Iraq and in Syria has really spiraled out of control in the last few years. For example, in Syria, there are more than 250 Iranian soldiers who were killed in Syria in the last 6 months or so. So it's a real involvement there. You know, we're talking about hundreds of troops being killed, thousands of troops and militias who are being sent there by the Iranian authorities. So the attack on Fallujah is definitely being supported by the Iranian government and the Iranian militias. And these militias have been committing atrocities and supporting Iraqi groups in committing crimes. Unfortunately, the United States has either given this intervention a blind eye, or in many cases have supported it indirectly by funding and training the Iraqi authorities and militias affiliated with the Iraqi authorities while they are conducting these crimes with the help with Iranian militias in Iraq. If we take one step back, I think the U.S. is definitely responsible of the destruction of Iraq's sovereignty and ability to protect itself. The U.S. destroyed Iraq's capability to protect itself from Iran or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or other countries. But now Iran and other countries are causing as much of a damage as the United States has caused in the past by continuing to interfere in Iraq's domestic politics and now sending weapons and militias and army and armed forces to Iraq and Syria.
Well, Rajirat, obviously the government, or at least this is the assumption, that the government in Baghdad, and by the way, it's been under siege itself. There was a Muqtada Assad's people broke into the Green Zone in protest recently. So this is not exactly a popular government, and it's widely widely understood to be just absolutely rife with corruption. Fallujah itself is only 40 miles west of Baghdad, and the assumption is that there was a lot of pressure on the Iraqi leader, if that's not too generous a term, because of these terrorist bombings that Daesh was behind. I think about 150 people being killed recently in Baghdad, and they've linked it to Fallujah. Is that what propelled it? Because the question I would have is, the only way to get the Iraqi government to, in quotes, free their own country from the scourge of the Islamic State is in response to terrorist bombings as opposed to doing the job. And so you get the impression that they're not really either competent or motivated to take Fallujah or Mosul, but they're kind of being forced into it?
Yeah, I mean, the Iraqi government is one of the most corrupt governments in the world, according to Transparency International. And you're right to mention that even within Baghdad and among Iraqi Shiites, this government is not popular. There is an ongoing siege of the Green Zone that is mostly led by Iraqi Shiites in the south, but there are you know, other Iraqis from other ethnicities and sects who are participating in this what seems to be a small uprising against sectarianism and corruption in Baghdad. And the Iraqi government, like many other governments around the world, is using the fight against ISIS to justify their corruption and failure, and to tell people that they should be not criticizing their government at a time of war. You know, we also hear these calls here in the U.S. That we should focus on fighting the enemy rather than criticizing our own government and officials. I don't think many Iraqis buy these arguments, and not many Iraqis see that the attack on Fallujah or Mosul is the way to end extremism or terrorism. You know, Iraqis have been living through violence and attacks and bombardment for over 25 years now. The first U.S. bombs fell on Baghdad in 1991, and the U.S. never stopped bombing the country since. And I don't think many Iraqis believe that dropping more bombs will make the country peaceful, or that fighting extremism can be done by dropping more bombs, or that pushing Iraq towards stability and peace can be done through more military operations. Because the reason why ISIS and other sectarian militias exist, whether they were Sunni or Shiite or Kurdish, there are real reasons, there are root causes for why these groups exist. And the root causes mostly are based in Baghdad, in the Green Zone. So when people are revolting against the Iraqi government in Baghdad, it's not like they're trying to distract against the fight against extremism, but they see that as the fight against extremism, not the attacks on civilians in Fallujah and Mosul. The fight against extremism has to start from building a functional and non-sectarian governance system that would be able to provide for all Iraqis and protect all Iraqis. So that's why the two things are not disconnected. You know, the demonstrations and siege of the Green Zone that you mentioned, and the calls to eliminate extremism. These are not two disconnected things. They're actually the same fight.
Well, Riyad Jarrah, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I wish we could have, you know, stopped talking about the agony that this country's gone through. And I wish that people like Bush and Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld would have the decency to take responsibility for what they've wrought. But,
correct. And others, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the Obama administration is the fourth administration to continue the same policies. So it's not only the Bush administration's fault.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Riyad Jarrah, who is the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Services Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., focusing on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the theater of the absurd on Capitol Hill today. الأسود الأسود يا ويلي الثوب الأسود يا Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bob McIntyre, the Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, a nonpartisan research and advocacy group that fights for tax fairness at the federal, state, and local levels. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob McIntyre.
Thank you.
And there was quite a scene in the House today with angry House Republicans venting against the absentee IRS Commissioner John Koskinen, because they were angry that he didn't show up. And then in a kind of fit of pique, Representative Daryl Issa, who led the congressional investigation into the original issue that got the Republicans all upset about the idea that the IRS was somehow targeting conservative groups, he then refused to allow Koskinen's defense to be submitted into the record, which seems awfully petty. So do you think that the absence of the IRS commissioner today, even though he basically says, I got better things to do, which is like testify before the House Ways and Means Committee and do my job, he's already making it pretty clear that he thinks this is political theater. But it's also a poke in the eye for these guys. So are they going to go ahead and impeach him?
Not successfully, but you can never tell what the House of Representatives will do. You know, this whole thing started when the Tea Party all over the country was growing up, and a number of groups asked for not tax-exempt status, but nonprofit status. And many, many of these Tea Party applications said that their goal, you know, you're supposed to write down what you're going to do, their goal was to elect Republicans. Well, that's not allowed. You don't get nonprofit status if you're a political operation. So having seen so many of these, the IRS started flagging them, saying, I think all of these things are really political activities that don't qualify. It was totally reasonable. But, of course, if you're on the side of the Tea Party, then you think everything that might possibly affect you adversely must be unconstitutional and probably illegal and maybe set up by the devil. But it wasn't. It was just the IRS's job is to, you know, not give people nonprofit status if they, in fact, are doing something that doesn't qualify according to the law. Anyway, they made a big scandal out of it. They got the woman fired who was doing her job at the IRS. And then there was some issue about maybe one of her hard drives got lost or something, all this trivia. But the guy who's commissioner now had nothing to do with it. He was brought in to try to cheer things up. So the real story here is that the House of Representatives, the leadership there, has been trying desperately to make it easier for people who make a fair amount of money to cheat on their taxes. So they're cutting the IRS budget, they're making the IRS waste its time testifying on all these issues, and then they say, look how horrible you are, you're doing a terrible job, your customer service is a mess, we're going to cut your budget so you'll do it even worse. What a world.
Well, that's the surreal part about it, is that they've cut the budget, cut the enforcement budget, and it seems though, as a result, even if you take the assumption that they were operating out of sort of excessive partisan zeal and imagined somehow that the IRS was tipping the scales against conservatives and targeting conservative groups when there was no evidence. The evidence that was presented made it clear that they were looking at all groups that they thought were involved in partisan politics. But at the end of the day, didn't what they did effectively intimidate the IRS into pursuing these dark money vehicles like these 501c4s that don't have to reveal who these big donors are?
Well, that's true, too. I mean, once they got the Congress hounding them, they got frightened because, you know, the Congress does pass their budget, so they have to be responsible to it. And if the Congress is telling them, don't do your job when it comes to nonprofit activities, well, it's hard to do your job. And so, yes, this is all part of a piece of trying to, you know, elect Republicans and make it possible for people who are inclined to cheat on their taxes do it, because a lot of those people contribute to Republicans.
Well, the fact that the IRS commissioner, John Koskinen, he had nothing to do with this period that you're talking about, where a retired IRS official, Lois Lerner, was a sort of central figure in this trumped-up Republican case that somehow they were tipping the scales against conservatives. She resigned. They say some of her emails are missing. You said it mentioned a hard drive. Is that the best that they've got? I mean, remember, These are the guys that impeached the President of the United States over a consensual sexual act.
Well, they do seem to be quite fascinated with emails. You have to admit that. Whether it's Hillary's emails, the only emails in the State Department that weren't hacked, or Lois Lerner's missing a couple of emails or something. Yeah, it's all just... It's not just theater, political theater. Who would care about that? It's actually really trying to make it hard for the government to work because they dislike the government. I don't know why they run for office.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob McIntyre, director of Citizens for Tax Justice, a nonpartisan research and advocacy group that fights for tax fairness at the federal, state, and local level. So,
Let me point out, by the way, that I'm talking about the Republicans in the House now, but, you know, there have been many times when we've criticized Democrats, and there have been many times over the years where we're in league with a different group of Republicans to push for tax reforms that everybody was in favor of eventually. So we really it's hard to call the Republicans in the House anything but Republicans, but it's not because we're a Democratic group. We're not.
Right, and arguably... these people in the House that control the House, at least the Tea Party caucus being the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, they are not your fathers and grandfathers Republicans.
Well, they are actually basically the people who didn't want the Constitution of the United States passed because it gave the government the power to tax. So that's their ancestors.
But these are all, but just in terms of their intellectual consistency, if that's not too generous a description.
Oh, come on.
No, but I mean, the idea that these are the guys, you know, they won't even put up money to fight the Zika epidemic, which is could be a massive and expensive and devastating epidemic if it's not nipped in the bud, which, you know, 90 days later, they still haven't passed any money. Their justification for being penny wise and pound foolish is, oh, we can't blow out the budget because of the deficit. So, the guys that are saying the sky is falling because of the deficits are the same people who don't want the IRS to collect tax revenues, which is the only way to pay down a deficit.
That's true, and they're also the same guys who keep proposing gigantic tax cuts, which would make the deficit far bigger. Look at all of the Republican candidates were proposing gigantic tax cuts. You know, Donald Trump with his 10 or 12 trillion and Ted Cruz with something similar, and Jeb Bush with a sort of Trump light. I mean, and then they say they care about the deficit. They don't care about the deficit. They just dislike the government.
So they've done a pretty good job then by cutting the IRS's budget. Has there been a detectable drop in revenue? I mean, I know that the Enforcement Division just simply is spread too thin to go after tax cheats.
Well, you know, it's a hard thing to measure, but we do know that audits are down on the high-income people, and we know that customer service cratered out a year or so ago. It's getting a little bit better now, but it's still horrible. You call the IRS, you're in a long line, and you may never get your questions answered. In fact, they're now saying, we can only answer the simple questions. Well, who calls the IRS for a simple question?
Well, but they obviously... they've been successful at demonizing not just the government, but the IRS. I mean...
Right. Well, the IRS is sort of the reason we have a government, when you think about it.
Right. Well, it's the only part of the government...
Ted Cruz said he was going to abolish the IRS.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things we do is analyze tax proposals, whether by candidates or legislators or whatever. And when Cruz's plan came out, and you know, it was a national sales tax and repeal the income tax and so forth, but... And then he said, and I'm going to abolish the IRS. And I said, this is the easiest one to estimate ever.
Right.
You know, you look at what revenues are supposed to be, and that's the answer.
Right.
But of course, he didn't really mean it. He said he was going to rename it the SRI or something.
Well, but as I say, it's an easy target to demonize. But ironically, it's actually the only part of the government that makes any money. The rest of the government wastes money, arguably.
Well, not all waste.
No, I know. But in other words, at least they bring some money in as opposed to have it go out the door for the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in the history of man that doesn't work, you know.
Yes, but I mean the real point though is, without a tax collecting agency, there would be no government. I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, some of them seem to think it would be the Garden of Eden. On the other hand, the Garden of Eden was in Iraq, as I remember, so it's not that great.
No. So just to go back to this threat to impeach the head of the IRS, the IRS commissioner, John Koskinen, it looks like it's real. They were so mad that he didn't show up, and then they got really petty and said they wouldn't even submit his defense into the record. So, but this would be the first impeachment. I mentioned in passing the impeachment of Bill Clinton, but this would be the first impeachment, I'm understanding, of a government official since 1876. Is that your understanding?
Right. I think there's been a couple of judges, but people in the executive branch basically never happened except once or twice. And, of course, it's not going anywhere. The House can pass it if they want. The Senate has to have a two-thirds vote to convict, and they're not even going to bring it up.
Right.
So it's all for show.
So why would Mitch McConnell, who's obviously incredibly partisan, not want to help out his colleagues in the House?
Well, Mitch McConnell may not be my or your favorite senator, but he can be embarrassed, and this is embarrassing. And to waste the Senate's time on it while they're trying to make the Senate work a little better, not very successfully, but they're trying, so they don't look like they're just the party of no. The Senate thinks that anyway, the Senate leadership. So I don't think that they would even bring the thing up.
So what's the next installment or next act in this theater of the absurd?
Well, you know, you think you've heard the craziest thing that they can think of, and then they come up with something that you never thought was possible. I mean, impeaching the IRS commissioner is ridiculous, but maybe they have something else. Maybe they'll impeach the chief. I don't know.
Right. But will they actually put together the articles of impeachment and send them over to the Senate, do you think?
If they can get enough votes, yeah. I think they would do it. I mean, they did try to repeal Obamacare about 100 times.
They like to
waste time.
Right. But they actually had the votes, even though it didn't go anywhere. They do have a majority. So I was just trying to figure out whether this is just venting that's going on, as we saw today in this hearing with Darrell Issa venting against the IRS Commissioner John Koskinen. But surely, are they just going to sort of, this is it, a little bit of theater and then move on? Or do you think they're actually not bluffing? I mean, even if it's dead on arrival in the Senate, that's not going to stop these guys from beating this dead horse, is it?
Well, it may encourage them. I mean, Paul Ryan, obviously, at least I don't think Paul Ryan thinks this is a good idea. On the other hand, he can't control these people any better than John Boehner.
And Jason Chaffetz, the Republican from Utah, he's a Tea Party guy as well, isn't he? I mean, ISA is just a grandstanding opportunist, as far as I can tell. I'm not sure that he has any politics or any kind of core convictions. But Chaffetz is a Tea Party guy, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
So there, your sense is that this is going to go ahead then?
I don't really have a prediction.
Right.
You know, it could be blocked by the Speaker, Paul Ryan,
right,
on the grounds that we don't need to look any stupider than we already are.
That's what he'd be saying in private, right?
I think so.
But so when the Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, comes out and says John Koskinen is the outstanding public servant of the highest integrity from the day he began his leadership for the IRS, John and his staff have cooperated with Congress, that is basically falling on deaf ears, right? That, first of all, again, we've got to make the point that this guy wasn't even around when this alleged scandal happened over tilting the scale against the conservatives under Lois Lerner, right? So,
if St. Matthew was the head of the IRS, they would go after him if it was in an Obama administration.
So we're just in a kind of fact-free world here, right?
We're in a world where there are members of the American public who will reward them, the Congress people who propose this, by reelecting them, because a lot of the public thinks that the IRS is a terrible, awful agency. Wouldn't it be better if we had no taxes? But, you know, that's America. We, like any other country, perhaps a little more, have some people that are kind of insane.
Right. But the point that we were making earlier, though, is that they've already, as crazy as they are, they've already succeeded in intimidating the IRS into not policing these dark money vehicles that are being used in this election. And for all of the speaking fees that Hillary Clinton has taken, which all of which are on the public record, there's no public record of all the money that's pouring in to Republican candidates because of this, these 501c4s, supposedly dedicated to social welfare, are being used by big donors to hide their identities. So this is the part of it that's actually working for them. So, and by the way, these guys who want to get rid of the government and appealing to the votes of the average guys, the average people that are going to vote for Donald Trump, their real mission in life seems to be to enrich and protect the plutocrats.
Well, I think they make that pretty clear. I mean, you look at the what they propose for budgets and legislation, and it's always tax cuts for the rich and less programs for those in need. Less programs to build the infrastructure, less programs for education, less programs to save the environment. They only have one goal. You almost think that they would like all the money in the country to be owned by one person.
But just in closing, though, they have been successful in...
They have been successful, and it's a tragedy that they've been successful.
And this is extremely relevant to this election year, is it not?
Yeah.
The
message to the American public is, do you really want crazy people running the government? I guess we'll find out in this presidential election.
Right. But the way that the crazy people might get elected in this country is because they've succeeded in having these dark money vehicles.
Well, we'll see. It didn't work very well for Jeb.
Well, but it is. The money's pouring in as we speak, though. Let's face it.
That is true. And to both parties, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's a bipartisan scandal. And, of course, most of the money ends up going to the mainstream media networks, television in particular. So,
well, we're all in favor of the media, right?
Yeah, well, that's why the head of the CBS recently said, you know, Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he's awfully good for CBS. So they're the end of the day, they are the beneficiaries, largely, of our broken political system. I thank you for joining us, Bob McIntyre. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bob McIntyre, Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, a nonpartisan research and advocacy group that fights for tax fairness at the federal, state, and local levels. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.